It's a pleasure for me to share the lectures of this day. Yeah? And the first talk will be by Enrique Suar on homogenization and numerical approximation of elliptic problems.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for thank you to the organizers of this semester for giving me the opportunity to be here, and also for this occasion to deliver this talk. Well, as you see, the title is quite ambitious. The talk, the content of the talk will be much more modest. The only thing I can promise is that you will see a few issues related to homogenization, numerical approximation, and elliptic problems. But, you know, the content of my lecture will be far from being a complete picture of all possible pathologies and results arising in this field. Well, I will briefly introduce the topic, then discuss mainly the one-dimensional case, mainly because notations become tough when we go to multidimensional problems, but the ideas are the same. And then I will explain you how to address these problems using block waves. Finally, some numerical experiments and some conclusions if I have time to. Okay, so first of all, what is the goal? The goal is do numerical approximation of PDEs or ODEs in the presence of rapidly oscillating coefficients. As you know, there is an extensive literature on homogenization problems, both using numerical analysis and the theory of homogenization, which is more based on continuous analysis, PDE theory. And there are many books on this. In particular, there is a very well-known classical book by Bensusan, Lyons, Pampalikunau. More recently, there was a more recent and updated and compact presentation of that by Fioranescu and Donato, but there are many others. However, the lecture I will deliver will rather follow works on the use of some possible ideas about ergodicity on the numerical analysis of these problems, which are mainly due to people like Bjorn Enquist, Tom Howe, and some others that I will mention later. As I mentioned before, the goal is to produce efficient numerical methods for solving PDEs in very heterogeneous media. Heterogeneities may be of different types. The first one maybe is the case in which the coefficients of your PDE oscillate very much, as in this picture. But there are some other possibilities, like oscillating boundaries, or even domains with many little perforations, which arise very often when you do optimal design, in which the topology of the domain is also a variable for design or control. So these three problems, variable coefficients, oscillating boundaries, perforations, yes?
I would still like to ask, can you say in one word, what is homogenization?
Yes, I'm saying it later, right? Precisely, this is the goal of this transparency. So after all, we all agree that all these three problems can be written in this kind of abstract or general form, A epsilon U epsilon equal F, right? Epsilon is the small parameter measuring the oscillations of the coefficients or the oscillations of the boundary or the characteristic size of the perforations or some other heterogeneities that may arise, okay? So we are dealing with different kind of problems. Here I will discuss only elliptic problems, but they could be other evolution problems defined on those heterogeneous media. And the theory of homogenization precisely is dealing with the analysis of the limit of U epsilon. So what you would like to say is, what is the limit of the solutions of this ODE or PDE with these oscillating coefficients or oscillating geometries as the oscillation parameter goes to zero? Of course, you are hoping some averaging to happen, right? Typically, coefficients that are oscillating very fast will homogenize to some constant average coefficients, the holes, the little holes when epsilon goes to zero will disappear, but probably will leave some trace on the metric of the domain. Or the oscillating boundaries also will be averaged to some, average, a smooth boundary without oscillations. So the theory of homogenization is precisely analyzing the limit of this kind of problems when epsilon goes to zero. And there is a huge literature, and this can be very difficult. You can do it for linear, nonlinear, evolution, static, deterministic, stochastic, and still many problems are open, of course. Now, but I would like to emphasize that the original goal of this theory of homogenization, if I understand correctly, was to produce numerical methods for solving efficiently this problem, not when epsilon goes to zero, but rather when epsilon is very small but positive, say 1 over 1,000. Because in practice, the medium in which you are really willing to resolve your PDE is heterogeneous. So what happens then when you do classical numerical analysis? You can do it. You can take your preferred method, finite differences or finite elements, for instance, and apply them directly in this very heterogeneous medium. It works. The problem is that these methods become efficient only when the mesh size of the numerical mesh, little h, is much smaller than epsilon. And I will describe this later. Okay? So you need really the mesh to be very small in order that your numerical convergence results to be true. And this, of course, when epsilon is very small, might become unfeasible. Now, homogenization theory is aimed to find a shortcut to this difficulty about building efficient numerical methods. The idea is the following. Say, well, since the difficulty, the need of taking h very, very little, is due to the rapid oscillations of coefficients, let us first pass to the limit as epsilon goes to zero and trying to find a PDE which is homogenized, is averaged, which mimics the behavior in this very oscillating medium, but in which, hopefully, the coefficients are now constant or smooth, the boundaries are also smooth, the little perforations disappear, and so on. If I am able to do that, and as I said, there is a huge literature on doing that for many different problems, quite technical in general, then the idea is that when you are trying to compute a numerical approximation for u epsilon, use this limit homogenized A star problem as a tool, and then do numerics on it. So instead of aiming to compute U star, which is still a PDE problem, let us do numerics on it, introduce some little h parameter, and in this way get an approximation U star h of U star, which is close to U epsilon, and this should be a good approximation for our problem. What is the drawback? The drawback is that at best, these solutions will stay at an epsilon distance from U epsilon. There is nothing.
In what norm?
Well, L2, H1, depending on the problem, you will have a natural norm. But typically, well, it could be also a power of epsilon. But the idea I would like to emphasize is that since you are not really approximating U epsilon but U star, there is a minimal distance between U epsilon and U star you will always pay.
A star is an unknown. It has to be computed from the unit cell problem.
Of course. So as I said, in general, passing to the limit is a difficult task. I will give an example, which is the very baby example about this that already indicates that something is going on. Well, some facts that all these problems have in common. The first thing is that this is a problem in which two scales are involved, little h for the numerical mesh, little epsilon for the oscillations of the medium. Then, of course, since there are two parameters, two regimes arise. So three regimes, rather. H, very small. In this case, numerical analysis dominates. Epsilon, very small. In this case, homogenization or averaging dominates. And then the critical regime to which this lecture will be devoted. Also, as I said, the convergence is very slow Because if you really like your classical numerical scheme to be efficient on a very heterogeneous matrix, then H has to be very, very little. And then this is a topic I will the topic I will discuss today. Resonances may occur when epsilon is of the order of H. And then finally, this is a topic I will not address here, but it's very interesting. There are results indicating that the efficiency of the numerical methods improves if your Galerkin method, if the basis functions you choose for producing your numerical method is adapted to the topography. And this is natural, right? Otherwise, think on the classical finite element method in which you are using very symmetric triangles, but the topography is crazily oscillating. The method will take very, very long time before the solutions feel that they should also oscillate. And in fact, they have nothing to do with these very, you know, symmetric triangles you have produced. And there are very nice results on this by, in particular, Babushka and Schwab. Okay, there are, let me try to start. There are two different topics, which are slightly different, and before I go in, I would like to state precisely. So the first topic, and this was the original goal of the theory of homogenization, if I understand correctly, is to compute a numerical approximation of U epsilon. Let me call it U epsilon H, H for the mesh size. This is the goal. And as I said before, the theory of homogenization, quite sophisticated in general, is aimed to help on doing that. The second topic, which is much more on discrete dynamics, is rather say, well, let me forget about the theory of homogenization. Let me simply enter my discrete numerical parameter little h on the solution U epsilon and see what the limit of this discrete guy is. This can be complicated because we are dealing with discrete dynamics, discrete models. Now, what we can say is that, for sure, if we would like to have a complete understanding of these problems, we should, you know, rather be able to solve both of them and see what comes out. Now, the topic of my lecture today will be more closely related to these works by, as I mentioned before, people like Enquist, Tom Howe. Also, there is a paper by Avellaneda, Ho, and Papanicolaou, and so on, in which they indicate that, well, the efficiency of the methods improves if the numerical mesh, if the numerical method is designed with respect to the PD under consideration in some ergodic way. Okay, so what I am trying to say is the following. I recall again, I insist, we know that the continuous theory guarantees that U epsilon converges to some U star, which is hard to compute, but there is a technology for doing that. But, as we will see later, because of resonances, in general, we cannot guarantee that the limit of the numerical solutions will be the same. So, in general, if you simply do numerics naively on the epsilon problem, and you let little h go to zero as epsilon goes to zero as well, if you are not careful enough, you can get a different limit. Well, what these people have proved is that under some ergodicity condition, let us assume, for instance, that epsilon over h is irrational, to simplify the presentation, then you will get the right limit. And the goal of this lecture is to explain you what's going on. Try to do a careful computation in the case in which epsilon over h is rational, and in this way we will be able to get very explicit error bounds that by, you know, using elementary results on the Diophantine approximation will allow you to prove that when epsilon over h is irrational, you do recover indeed the right limit. But still, if you don't take epsilon over h irrational, you don't get the right limit, but proceeding as I will show you, you will get the wrong limit that you can compute explicitly, and you will check how far it is from the solution you wanted to compute. And actually, this could be my last transparency. The whole thing is over here. It's in this picture in which I am simply trying to explain that if this is the epsilon cell that is mimicking the oscillation of the original background, if you take the numerical mesh, little h, to be rational with respect to epsilon, then what happens is that in each of these unit cells, you are only visiting a finite number of points. So even though you might take h very, very small going to zero, even if h goes to zero, and then you think you are, you know, you are sampling the domain very, very, very precisely, you are not doing it because you are always visiting the same points on the unit cell, which is finite and is fixed a priori. So how can you recover the solution of a PDE if the solution, if the coefficients which are variable are only sampled on a finite number of points? This is simply impossible except for, you know, maybe constant coefficient problems. And this is what's going on. Let me show you what happens. So assume this is a one-dimensional a function depending on x in 1D, which is periodic of period 1. So take h over epsilon to be a rational number. Now consider the rapidly oscillating function ax over epsilon, which is oscillating more and more. Of course, this function converges weakly to its average. Now take the classical numerical grid, equidistributed, xj equal jh, and then compute the value of a epsilon, the rapidly oscillating function on xj. This is, by definition, ajh over epsilon, but h over epsilon is this rational number, so this is what you get. Now use the fact that a is periodic of period 1, and then you see immediately that on the discrete variable j, you have a periodicity of period p. That means that whatever you do, after p nodes, you will see the same thing in a again. So even if h is very, very little, because this is compatible, this rationality condition, of course, is compatible with the fact that h and epsilon go both to zero, even if they go to zero, you will only visit p points on the unit cell of the function a. So you will hardly recover, for instance, the average of a if you only know p values of it. Okay, and this is the classical picture about ergodicity. Now, what the model I will discuss, to be more precise, even though I will only explain how things can be written in 1D, because in several D they are more quite, the notations are much heavier. So this is the classical elliptic problem. This is a generalization of the Laplace operator in which the coefficients, the metric, and the underlying metric is variable. And then I am doing the classical assumptions about coefficients being bounded above, below, so that the problem is well posed. I assume them to be periodic. This is very important for all I will say. Of course, there are limitations, very serious limitations on what I am doing here. By now, it's only valid for periodic coefficients. And then you are introducing this small parameter epsilon, which is dividing x, and that makes the coefficients to oscillate faster and faster. As I said before several times, homogenization theory, there are books on it telling you that the limit behavior of these of the solutions for that operator are given by a different Laplacian in which the coefficients, which are the coefficient, homogenized coefficient, we denote them by this little star there, can be computed explicitly. Okay. Is this difficult or easy? Well, I always found this theory of homogenization a little bit mysterious, but there is one case in which everything can be done explicitly and you understand what's going on. So let me consider the 1D problem to convince you that something is going on. Then you write the weak form of the PDE, and this is what you get. A is bounded below and above, therefore there is a unique weak solution, no problem about this. We are in the classical frame of Lax-Milgram's theory in Hilbert spaces. Now, moreover, the solutions are bounded, and then you can pass to the limit. On the other hand, these coefficients are also bounded. A is bounded above, below, therefore, even though the oscillations are very fast, they are bounded, say, in L infinity, so you have a weak limit. The question is, so the weak limit, of course, is the average of A bar over bar. The question is, can we say that, consequently, the limit solution U will be the solution of the same PDE in which this coefficient is replaced by its average? Well, when you see this, you say, well, there seems to be some technical difficulty, right? Because weak and weak topology, I cannot pass to limits if I have a product of weak and weak topology. Is this a purely technical matter or something is going on? Let's see. Now you say, well, in 1D, I can compute everything by hand, because the PDE was saying that the first derivative of this guy was equal to f with a minus sign. So let's integrate. I forget about boundary conditions. They are irrelevant in here. So I get this identity. Now I say, well, out of it, I can easily get the derivative of u, which is the average of f divided by a, or the primitive of f divided by a. Now, passing to the limit on the right-hand side is very simple, because, again, this function is fixed. 1 over a is a periodic function, bounded below and above. I am oscillating very rapidly, therefore I converge to the average of 1 of a. Fine. And then the limit is u star x, which is the homogenized solution, the limit solution, is the average of 1 over a times the primitive of f. Now I write the PDE corresponding to this problem, and I realize, passing this guy to the left, that the right limit is given by the inverse of the average of the inverse. So you see that the computation of the effective coefficient is nonlinear on A. It's not any longer the average of A, as we could have expected, but it's something different. It's the inverse of the average of A that, of course, doesn't coincide with the average of A, except for the fact, except in the case in which A is trivial, in which we are not interested. So you see, homogenization theory, this is 1D, everything is explicit. In multi-D, you have ways of doing that. It's more sophisticated. But in general, you can keep in mind that the limit is often not the first object you may guess.
But if it's inverse, is it linear?
Excuse me?
It's inverse of this, right? It depends on linearly or linearly?
Non-linearly. Because this is a non-linear operator, right?
Oh, okay, average.
You are averaging the inverse, so this is a non-linear operator. In any case, it's not the average of A. This is what I wanted to say.
For physics, the conductivity is not linear, but if it is resistivity, it is a linear. Right?
Sure. If you put a density function on the right-hand side, then you will get, of course, if you write here a density function, rho x over epsilon, then you pass to the limit and you get the average, no problem. Okay. But I think from a mathematical point of view, it's nice to do this exercise to know what are we dealing with. Now, what happens when you do numerics? So let us take a grid, h. You can think in 1D, in which there is only one h, is 1 over n, a natural number, and then you write your finite difference numerical scheme. The same I'm saying here could be done for finite elements on regular grids. We are sampling on the points that are suitable for getting a nice discretization, and this is explained here. The key point is that when you do this, the numerical solution approximating the epsilon problem will be far from u star by this constant in which there are two ingredients. You see, the two ingredients have different nature. The second one, epsilon, is the one appearing when you pass to the limit from u epsilon to u star, is the continuous theory. The second one is a purely numerical artifact, is due to the fact that we have discretized the epsilon problem in space. But of course, then you pay a 1 over epsilon. Why? Because if you use classical error estimates, you will have to use the Lipschitz constant on the coefficients. And then the Lipschitz constant on the coefficients, AX over epsilon, provides you an 1 over epsilon term. So this is the error estimate you get by classical analysis. And this is what tells you that, indeed, the methods are only efficient, classical methods are only efficient when h is much smaller than epsilon. So in particular, this inequality doesn't guarantee convergence when h is of the order of epsilon, say epsilon over 1,000.
It really seems that the first term is related to the H1 norm, and the second term is related to the L2 norm, right?
It could be, yeah. But again, I insist that, you know, there are two terms in the error, and this is the key one, right? So h over epsilon appears always. Therefore, when h is of the order of epsilon, a convergence cannot be guaranteed. But you are right. Maybe this was one for the L2 norm, and this was one for the H1 norm. Okay, and this is the picture. And this is precisely why people, the works I mentioned before by Babushka and Schwab and some others, in which they will build in Galerkin methods with bases adapted to the topography of the oscillating problem in order to avoid this long transition of numerical methods before convergence appears. So here I am drawing 1 over h. H is going to 0, 1 over h is going to infinity. And what I am trying to emphasize over here is that for a long time, before little h becomes really very, very small, the numerical method doesn't really converge. You only see convergence after h is smaller than epsilon, right? So these other methods based on the use of a suitable Galerkin basis adapted to the topography allows you to go down directly without this very slow transition here. Okay, so this is I have taken one of the statements in this paper by Avellaneda, Ho, and Papanicolaou in order to illustrate what I was trying to say. So they prove the following result. This is in 1D, in several D there is a version of this also. But the result says, well, assume your problem has periodic coefficients, you do the classical finite difference method, and then take H over epsilon to be irrational, then you converge. You converge to the classical homogenized problem. Right? So you see that here I am rather dealing with the second question I mentioned before. I am not trying to compute efficiently U epsilon, but I am rather looking to the discrete dynamics of this discrete solution U epsilon H. And I am trying to see whether the numerical solutions homogenize or converge to the same limit as the classical continuous homogenization theory. And what they say is this is correct provided H over epsilon is irrational. Our goal, as I mentioned before, is to do it in the case of rational quotients and prove some, you know, sharp explicit bounds. And the way I will do that is using Bloch or Floquet theory, as you may guess. Okay, so some notation. We will fix for the rest of this lecture H over epsilon to be a rational number, Q over P. As I have said before, since in that case the numerical method is only sampling a finite number of points on the relevant unit cell of the coefficient A, the numerical solutions don't converge to the same, they cannot converge to the same limit, but they rather converge to what I call here U star Q over P, which is the homogenized version of the numerical solutions which correspond to this ratio Q over P I have chosen and fixed for the analysis. Okay, the first claim is that U star Q over P is not U star. And the second one is that you can make U star Q over P to converge to U star as QP converges to an irrational number, simply because the number of points you are sampling on the unit cell will then increase. Actually, when you check things explicitly, what you see is that U star Q over P, the limit of the discrete solutions as both H and epsilon go to zero, is also a solution of a problem of the same form, except for the fact that the coefficient here is the inverse of some discrete average of 1 over A. So this result is satisfactory in the sense that you see the same features as in the continuous homogeneous problem, is the reverse of the average of 1 over A, except for the fact that here, of course, since we are only sampling on a finite number of points, the best we can do is a discrete average of 1 over A. Okay? This is the limit of the discrete problem. And this explains why the limit of U H epsilon is not U star, but rather something which is close, but not identical. Now, can you compute the distance between this U star Q over P and the actual U star? Then, of course, you can do it, because these are similar problems in which the coefficients vary, because in one case I have taken the continuous average and the other one I have taken the discrete average. You can compare both of them and you end up getting this kind of estimates. Now, again, in the estimates I have two terms. Before it was H over epsilon and epsilon. Now I have HP and 1 over P. But this now is compatible with convergence. Why? Because P is the denominator of the rational number. Make this rational number to get closer to irrational, then the denominator will go to infinity. This guy will go to zero. And then p going to infinity, you take h going to zero faster. This one goes to zero. But I recall you that all this is compatible with taking h over epsilon equal to something which is basically fixed, right? This is rational converging to irrational, but this will be always be of the order of some given irrational number, say pi. That means that finally, the numerical homogenization, the convergence to the right continuous homogenized limit, is guaranteed by taking h of the same order as epsilon, provided that their ratio is essentially irrational. But I insist, you can take here, not only take h to be of the order of epsilon, but you could even take it to be larger than epsilon, and the convergence is guaranteed. Can you could take pi, for instance. Okay. Of course, in 1D, you can do everything by hand. You write the finite difference scheme for your second order PDE. This becomes a discrete equation in 1D. You can integrate it by parts in a discrete way. And then if you are careful enough, you will pass to the limit and you will indeed recover this kind of inverses of averages of inverses that give you the right limit. Okay, so this is 1D. Of course, if you are in multi-D, you cannot do that. And this is why we proceed in a different way in order to provide a much more systematic method of doing it. Okay, so the way we did it, we followed the classical approach of Bloch or Floquet theory, following the presentation by Konka and Van Inatan in this article in Siam Journal of Applied Mathematics in 1997. So the idea, as you know, is very simple. You have to produce a copy of a periodic function. You have to produce a copy of a function on the real line, but only on a finite interval. So you will put one over the other all the sections of this function. But in order not to get mixed with all of them, you will introduce some rotation of the phase. And when you do that, you will reduce your PDE or your ODE to an ODE in a bounded interval, but with an extra dual parameter that is taking care of this phase shift. Okay, so finally, you can produce a complete spectral decomposition of your operator by simply looking to these spectral problems, in which the novelty with respect to classical spectral problems for Sturm-Liouville equations is that the periodicity conditions we have on the solutions are not the classical ones, but they are shifted because of this extra eta parameter over here. So you can keep in mind that you can produce a complete Bloch or Floquet decomposition of your PDE operator by looking to these spectral problems, in which the only novelty with respect to classical Sturm-Liouville theory is that the periodicity conditions have been shifted, and the shift depends on this eta parameter which lives in the dual cell. Once you have done this, for every eta, you have a sequence of eigenvalues. All problems are self-adjoint, positive eigenvalues, and so on. And what is more important, the second eigenvalue and all others, they are always above the second eigenvalue of the Neumann problem. This is simply using comparison in the Rayleigh quotient characterization of eigenvalues. So simply by comparison, you see that all but the first eigenvalue are far from zero. Then the corresponding eigenfunctions, of course, constitute orthonormal basis of L2 in the unit cell. And then once you scale everything up, taking into account the epsilon parameter, what you see is a complete representation of the solution. Maybe you can look directly in here, in which you recognize typically what you get when you apply the Fourier transform in a PDE operator. So your PDE is now transformed into a sequence or a family of algebraic equations in which you have the index m for the eigenvalues, and you have the eta dual parameter. For every eta and every m, you have an algebraic equation you can solve, and then due to these generalized Parseval identities, you can recover fully the solution and also its norm. When you do that, you end up getting an expression like this. So you have an infinite sum, an integral over the dual cell of the solutions of these Fourier problems. But what is more relevant is, because I said that all but the first eigenvalue are far from zero, and since you are dividing the denominator, you are multiplying by epsilon squared, then all the components except for the first one go to zero. So in the end, in order to really get the limit of u epsilon, the only thing you have to take care of is about this first Fourier or Bloch component. Now, what is the difficulty when doing that? Well, this is a classical limit problem in oscillatory integrals. So here, lambda 1 is flat, because lambda 1, when eta equals 0 is the classical periodic problem, and the first eigenvalue for the Sturlieville problem with periodic boundary conditions is the 0, 1. So eta 1 goes to 0 when eta goes to 0, and epsilon squared is going to 0. So you have to look to the Taylor expansion of lambda 1, and then computing, you easily see that not only lambda 1 is 0, but the first derivative is 0 as well. But then when you compute the second derivative, it's definite positive. This is something you can check. And then lambda 1 has this parabolic shape. What is extremely interesting is that the homogeneized coefficients are precisely the Hessian of this first eigenvalue. So this is a different way of doing homogenization by simply following this Fourier way of thinking. Okay, so I should underline here that this critical step in which I am jumping from the infinite sum into the first Bloch component works on the elliptic problem I am considering here, works also for parabolic problems in which there is a lot of dissipation and high frequencies are damped out, but for instance, this is no longer true for hyperbolic problems in which all the Bloch components are kept with the same energy for a long time. So doing this for hyperbolic problems is much more complicated, of course. But let me emphasize that without knowing anything about homogenization theory, if you follow this procedure, you compute things in this Fourier or Bloch way, and then you look to the limit of this, you will naturally end up by finding the homogenized coefficients in a different way. So in the end, you pass to the limit on the solution u epsilon, you get this, and once you have this, you say, well, I recognize this as being the solution of the elliptic problems with these efficient coefficients on the Hull space and its Fourier transform. Okay, so now what we did, and I think I will not have time to explain you this in detail, but I think you don't want to need it, you don't want to listen to that. The ideas are very simple, so let's do the same at the numerical level. Why not? The idea here was take a continuous problem on a periodic background and do Floquet theory. Why not doing that on the discrete problem? And this is completely possible. So, as I said before, in 1D, we can use explicit computations, but of course this is impossible in multi-D. This is a good reason for jumping to this other approach using Bloch waves. In 1D, the homogeneized coefficient A star can be computed explicitly as that average. In multi-D, it is more difficult to characterize A star, but there are systematic ways of doing that, and the one I have shown you here using Bloch waves is one of them. Okay? And simply to show you how things appear, if you try to do this Bloch theory for the discrete problem, it's just a matter of writing things carefully, you can do it. As I mentioned before, the discrete coefficients now are p-periodic on the discrete grid. So you can take, you know, the p-first integers as the unit cell for the discrete problem. You can periodize that. You can apply Bloch or Floquet theory on the numerical scheme. And if you are careful enough, you will end up with the same decomposition in which you have a dual variable, you have a sequence of eigenvalues, all but the first eigenvalue are away from zero, the first eigenvalue will vanish, and then when you compute the second derivative of the eigenvalue, you will get the right homogenized limit of numerical solutions, and when you will check 1D to see whether things fit with your previous explicit computation, you will see that indeed it is the case. But this time, you will not limit it to 1D. This will be a theory for all dimensions. Okay, So I think I can show you very briefly the... We have made a test by simply taking coefficient A of x, which is something like 1 plus 1 half of a sinusoidal function, so it's not something smooth and periodic, and you see immediately what the theory predicts. If you take h and epsilon going to 0, but with the same rational ratio, then what you see is that the error here, u star u epsilon h, stabilizes very soon. But this has to be that way, because we have proved now that the limit of u h epsilon is an u star q over p, which is not u star. So, of course, the limit has to be this distance on the two limits, which is non-trivial. But now if you do the same thing, but by taking h over epsilon of the same order, but approximating an irrational number, you see how fast this goes down to zero. So this is simply to convince you that what analysis says is correct. And this is the conclusion. So discrete block waves allow getting a complete representation formula for numerical approximations. In the case of rational ratio, this allows deriving the efficient homogenized limit for discrete solutions. They have the same structure, but they don't have the same coefficients. The distance between the two media, the two homogenized media, the continuous and the discrete one, can be estimated because we get their shape. We have an explicit formula for them, and then we can compare. This is simple interpolation. And this allows recovering with convergence rate results that were previously proved by in the literature I mentioned before, using ideas based on ergodicity. You can find all these computations in this article. I'm not sure you want to read them, but I would rather suggest that now that you have the idea, you can do it yourself, and it will be easier. And of course, I should say to conclude that there is a lot to be done. I mean, the range of application of this method is basically, I will say, the example I have shown you here, right? Periodic coefficients, linear problems. If you try to do boundary value problems, nonlinear problems, non-periodic coefficients, there is a lot to be understood. But I think, well, probably I now that I was in this interesting workshop for 1 week, and I have seen so many people going through solving efficiently ODEs with multi-scales and rapidly oscillating coefficients, I suspect that what I did here, at least in the one-dimensional context, is something that might be very familiar for you. In any case, it's something, of course, that you can also apply for ODEs with some periodic background. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for this interesting talk. Other questions, comments?
I didn't quite catch. I thought that first when you explained to us that if the ratio is rational, right, there is no convergence. But then if it is irrational, there is a convergence. I mean, if check with the convergence rate, presumably it will depend on how much irrational it is, right? It's not
time, sure. Yes, of course. I mean, you can use the classical, I think it's Dirichlet theorem, right? So there is some minimal convergence, but if you want to say more, then you have to say in which class of irrationality your R is. And then, of course, you will have, Liouville numbers and all these pathologies. But you can use the Dirichlet theorem about the approximation of irrationals by rational, and then you have some universal convergence rate. Okay? But of course, more can be said if you know more about the irrational number.
You kept showing up results comparing this finite difference approximation with solution of a homogenized problem, right? Not of the original sort of exact solution.
No, I am doing numerical approximations of the original problem, of the epsilon problem. This is why the coefficients look so ugly, right? This is the problem you are dealing with. You are taking the oscillating coefficients and you are sampling them on the numerical grid. So the numerical problem you are getting has discrete but very oscillating coefficients as well.
The error bounds, like your epsilon h, compared to U star, right? U star is the solution of the homogenized problem, right?
U star is the solution of the homogeneous problem. So there are two objects. Well, there are U epsilon is the solution of the PDE. U epsilon H is the numerical approximation of the PDE. This is the object I am interested in it. U star is the continuous homogenized limit. And U star Q over P is the discrete homogenized limit. And what we discover is that, well, we rediscover that there is a discrete homogenized limit which is different from U star, and we are able to say both how fast the numerical solutions converge to this discrete homogenized limit, and second, how far this discrete homogenized limit is from the continuous homogenized limit.
Another short question.
So what happens for almost periodic coefficients?
I don't know. This is something to be tested. We already had enough difficulties on this one, but conceptually, I think this is indeed the next problem to be discussed, even in 1D. I insist that you can really ask the same question about take an ODE in 1D with periodic coefficients, put some rapidly oscillating parameter there, and then try to do numerics. The same phenomena arise. So maybe before doing that, we should consider rather ODEs in 1D, even of first order, to see how things happen.
Okay, let us thank.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.